Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center. Adam Carroll, good morning.
Good morning. We're starting off the day with those clear to partly cloudy skies across Park City. And it will eventually lead to increasing clouds this afternoon with another round of some snow shower activity here across Park City that will linger into tomorrow as this continued pesky, persistent area of low pressure slowly moves off to the east. And this is what that story that you just put on about the historic winter storm that's about ready to hit Denver, this is that same area of low pressure that will continue to strengthen as it progresses to the east. Now, the Wasatch Back will continue to deal with the light snow showers. And, you know, you might still pick up a few inches here between now and end of day tomorrow with temperatures in and around 37 here both today and tomorrow, actually, with still teens for overnight lows. But by the time we get to Saturday night, we're really starting to clear things out, and we're going to end up having a pretty decent latter half of the weekend with highs returning to the mid-40s under partly cloudy skies and just drier conditions overall. That leads into a similar day Monday ahead of another storm that arrives with colder temperatures, more snow for Park City and the mountains locally before we end up having a fairly dry end to next week as we warm up to near 50 by that point. So still a couple more unsettled, wintry days ahead. But you know, we talk about almost every day and every week, the drought. We need the precipitation, and let's keep bringing it on the snow as we head towards the runoff.
Okay, have a great weekend. Thanks, Adam.
Yep, you too.
And on the phone with a look in the backcountry, we've got Nikki from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning. So like you just said, the snow total amounts are between 7 and 14 inches since Wednesday, and they have been favoring the Park City ridgeline. Following the initial new snow on Wednesday, the sun came out, and it made that new snow damp on the east, south, and west aspects. And then those refroze overnight, leaving a firm riding surface before yesterday's new snow. So overall, the riding conditions have really improved over this week. On the solar aspects, you're still going to feel that firm riding surface underneath the new snow. And in more protected areas, like north-facing aspects, it's going to have the best riding. Yesterday, there were a few new snow avalanches, loose, fast-running sloughs, and during the highest period of snowfall rates between 1 and 3 p.m., there was a small natural soft slab cycle reported. These avalanches were just 5 inches deep and relatively harmless to people in size, so D1. Today we've got normal caution again. We've got two issues, the first being new snow. That new snow has fallen on an array of firm surfaces in the backcountry. For that reason, we'd expect to see shallow new snow avalanches today. Most concerned about fast-running sloughs and steep terrain, but in those north-facing aspects, we could find some shallow, soft slabs as well. Just remember that even a small avalanche can be problematic in steep, complicated terrain. So today's the day to think about what type of terrain you're traveling above. We've also got the slide for life melt freeze crust we keep talking about. The new snow could easily slide off this really firm, icy slope. So hard icing conditions aren't an avalanche concern, but a hazard nonetheless. So in steep terrain, think about how you're skiing and if you'd be able to arrest. So today we've got low avalanche danger. Watch for unstable snow on isolated terrain features, and remember that risk is inherent in mountain travel.
Okay. Thanks, Nikki. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Kim Carson, former county council member, also a member of the Snyderville Basin Transit District. They met yesterday. She's got some updates there. Park City Council Member Steve Joyce with a recap of last night's meeting. And finally, Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis with an update on county business there. Stay tuned. Well, during their meeting on Tuesday, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission looked at two projects in Lower Silver Creek. For one of them, the Planning Commission sent a negative recommendation to the County Council for the second time in recent months. Rick Bruff has more.
During that non-voting work session, the Snyderville Commission was introduced to a proposal from Anaya's Market, which is moving from Park City's Bonanza area to a site in Lower Silver Creek, northeast of the Bell Station. The two-building project, which would include a market, cafe, deli, small retail offices, and affordable residential units, is looking for a plat amendment, low-impact permit, and conditional use permit. Snyderville Chairman Ryan Dickey said his group was receptive to the plan. However, he said the proposal would combine two lots, and he has some concern about what an approval might lead to in the future.
Well, that's a concern I continue to have anytime we talk about combining lots, is that we're creating an attractive target for a big box store when we do that. And generally, we'd like a greater diversity of commercial where we have it. So what we ask is that staff, when it comes back, to include a specific condition related to an inability to put one single large structure on the parcel. So I expect it to come back with that condition next time.
Next, an application for the Huamaway Ranch Indoor Riding Arena and Horse Boarding Facility came back to the Snyderville Commission. In November, they voted against a conditional use permit for the project. The applicant appealed to County Council. Last month, the council sent the project back to Snyderville Planning after Huamaway's owner agreed to make some changes to colors and materials. But on Tuesday, the Snyderville Commission again sent on a negative recommendation. Dickey said they found that the plan didn't comply with a human scale required from county code. He noted that is a subjective concept.
There is a provision in the code that buildings and structures shall provide a human scale consistent with adjacent development and appropriate to residential uses and consistent with other development in the zone. There's a question about this one of when we talk about adjacent development, what are we talking about? Are we talking about just residential development in the Snyderville Basin, or are we talking about adjacent, you know, the neighborhood, the street, you know, a true adjacency? And then when we talk about human scale, what do we mean? It's something that's obviously very subjective, and it matters where you're standing. If you're standing in the street, if you're standing next to the building, what do you see? How does the scale feel?
He said it's a narrowly decided issue, and the Snyderville commissioners came down with a divided vote, 4-2. The dissenters in favor of the ranch were Planning Commissioners Joel Fine and Bruce Carmichael.
Probably the through line of those who've said no, meaning that the barn is just provides a scale that's just too large compared to the neighborhood, was that we felt that this part of the code is talking about adjacent development. It's talking about this part of Silver Creek. You know, there are parts of Silver Creek that have much larger parcels where the scale could be quite a bit different, and where adjacent development is different, but that what was being proposed here as an accessory building was just really quite different and at a much larger scale than what's up and down the street and around that part of the neighborhood.
Snyderville Planning Chairman Ryan Dickey. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Snyderville Basin Public Transit District has a new name and will be meeting regularly between now and this summer when the transit rollover takes place. On the phone with a recap from yesterday's member, I have one of the members of the board, former County Council member Kim Carson. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the board has named the district the High Valley Transit District. Are we going to shorten that anyway, the HV, the HVT? I mean, is it just the High Valley Transit District?
For now, it's the High Valley Transit District. I'm sure in the future we will work with on marketing and how we can shorten that.
All right.
We wanted a name that would be able to be used as we hopefully expand across the Wasatch back, that would apply to any of our neighboring communities.
So is there a mission, a guiding principle for the district as it moves forward?
We have yet to develop that. We just had our first meeting the last week of January, and we're working on developing our policies and procedures and taking care of some other legal requirements, such as certification and assurances for FTA purposes, and looking at our agreement with Summit County to provide some of our staff services, such as legal and human resources. So it's a lot of just very general work. An exciting piece of it is we're looking, of course, at the draft service plan and how we'll make some tweaks to our current service to serve the entire Snyderville Basin, and then even some of our more regionalized areas like Camas and Colville.
Yeah, and you did hear from the county's contractor, VIA, to review that draft service plan. So let's run through what's being proposed. One of those is that we would combine two routes to get service all the way from Jeremy Ranch to Deer Valley at high frequency. So can you tell us what that looks like?
That's correct. So the 6 Lime and the 7 Pink will be combined. And right now we're just referring to that then as the new 6 Lime. And areas, so it'll go to basically the Jeremy Ranch Pine Brook exit all the way up to Deer Valley and be fairly direct. It won't replace the White Express. That'll still be a really key piece of the service for Park City Transit and High Valley Transit. But we'll be able to keep this at 15-minute intervals and do that year-round, which we think will provide a consistency that will really help improve ridership and the experience for our riders.
So will it make stops at Park City Mountain as well as the Old Town Transit Center?
At this point, I think it will still go into Park City Mountain.
Okay, but bypass the Old Town Transit Center.
No, it'll still stop at the Old Town Transit Center. Okay. And then proceed up to Deer Valley.
Okay. Any idea what that something like that is going to take in terms of minutes?
You know, I don't have that in front of me, what the total time is. I know it's much shorter than what you would currently experience. It no longer will route through, for instance, Silver Springs. And it also will remove the leg that goes up to Summit Park. However, that's being replaced with on-demand transit, or what we refer to as microtransit. So using an app that'll be kind of a one-stop shop, they'll be able to go in and plan their trip, and they should get access to a microtransit ride within 10 to 15 well, maybe up to 20 minutes from the time they select a ride. And then that will take them to the Lime route, to the main route, to the closest stop.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about... I want to talk a little bit about that in just a second, though. I just want to get more clear, though, on this new 6 Line. When you said it stops at Park City Mountain, is that at the Canyons Village or at the Park City Mountain base?
The map I still have, it shows it going to the Park City Mountain base.
Okay. All right. Well, then, yeah, so this app, this new on-demand transit service. So, let's use you as an example there in Silver Creek. You call 20 minutes later, you get a bus where? At your doorstep?
Yes. We have a map that has what we call the orange on-demand transit zone. And my house it shows service now to, for instance, Silver Creek Village, which isn't served, or Silver Creek, which isn't currently served. And so what you would do, it may require, since I'm outside the orange zone, I just have to get myself to the orange zone. So I would change my pickup location from my house, which would be outside the service area, to a spot within. Like, I could park my car at the mailboxes at the bottom of our neighborhood and have that be my pickup spot, and it would pick me up there and then take me to the closest place where I could pick up a bus.
Okay.
Or if I have another location that's my ultimate location, it may drop me off there if that's closer, or if they're on their way to pick up somebody else and it's convenient to do that.
Okay. So can you give us kind of the boundaries of this orange zone?
Well, it includes all of Jeremy Ranch, Pine Brook, Summit Park. It includes all of, for instance, Willow Creek area, Silver Springs, everything on the other side of the road, Sun Peak area. It includes Trailside. It also includes a zone up around Park City Hospital and the People's Health Clinic and the Health Department.
So when you say it includes all of Summit Park, are we talking that would go to the top of Summit Park for a single ride?
Yes.
Okay. And then the top of Daybreaker and Jeremy as well?
Uh-huh.
Okay. That just seems like... it just seems like a long way out of the way to get to somebody.
Well, with the microtransit, we'll have the flexibility to combine trips, and those vehicles can maneuver those roads where, you know, a full-size bus, of course, couldn't, and it would be much more expensive.
All right. So what are you using then to get up to? I mean, as you know, it's not easy sometimes to drive to the top of Summit Park. What kind of vehicle are you using to get there?
You know, I haven't heard an update on what type of vehicle. It will be a four-wheel drive van-type vehicle.
All right. And you had mentioned that one citizen had asked you if this is going to displace the private Uber Lyft businesses. Will it?
No. It's not meant to be a point-to-point service. So it's meant to get the people from their neighborhoods. I think of it like a collector system, and then get the rider to the main bus line.
Yeah, I know when Park
and
City...
And from there...
I know when Park City was looking at this microtransit, I mean, we saw rides as expensive as you know, $30, $40 a ride. Have we put the numbers to it, and can we afford it?
You know, we have a budget put together. We'll have a discussion on that at our next meeting in 2 weeks. So I can't talk about per ride costs. But when you're alleviating other routes, I mean, we've been able to put the pencil to this and overall to provide what we think will be improved service and reliability. Our overall budget will be less than our current contract with Park City Transit.
Wow. So what do we have in the budget? I mean, what is that budget?
Well,
at this
the
point?
Last, I don't have the final figures from 2020. Council may have discussed that in a meeting, but again, we'll get this information at our next meeting. But I know, like in 19, our budget was a little over $7.5 million for the transit program.
Okay, annually. And do we have any additional money that we're throwing into that?
Not at this point. There may be eventually as we begin our planning on capital needs. And there may be, you know, of course, expenses related to purchasing of some buses that'll be a permanent part of our fleet.
All right. There was also discussion about the Kimball Junction circulator, which would extend to Bittner Road. Why are we doing that?
To improve access for those neighborhoods in that tight area. Because what we're doing is the line used to have a pretty extensive detour in that area. So now we'll pick that up with the circulator.
Okay.
That area hasn't quite been finalized yet. But that is the plan, to have the circulator going through there on a regular route and then taking them straight to the line.
Yeah, so we're talking like the Canyon Creek neighborhood, basically along there to the fire district offices. And
right.
Then what about like Spring Creek? Does that get collected there as well?
Yes, I believe it would.
Okay. Does that then make the circulator just too long? I mean, and another reason why somebody wouldn't use it.
You know, I don't think so. And we'll monitor those types of things very closely to see if we need to put another vehicle on the circulator. There may be times of day when we need, more coverage.
Okay.
Morning and afternoon.
And then the Camas Black Bus would cover Francis as well, perhaps even Hideout. When does that get firmed up?
We hope to begin that service in July.
And will you be asking for any funds then from Camas and Francis and Hideout to help pay for it?
Initially not. With this one route. So, eventually we hope that they will join the district, especially as they want enhanced services.
All right. And then in terms of anything with Wasatch County, are you working on that as well?
We are. I know the council has entered into an interlocal agreement, kind of a memorandum of understanding to start studying routes. And of course, the transit district will become more involved now in those discussions as we're up and running.
All right. I understand that you also need to get an interlocal agreement with Park City as well. To what? Keep all of the buses and the...
Well, we still have some funding that we jointly agree on how it'll be distributed. So that'll be a piece of it. And we will still have an agreement on the White Express.
Okay. And then just some organizational things. What authority is delegated to you, the board, to the Caroline Rodriguez, the planning director, and acting general manager, and county manager Tom Fisher, and then the firm VIA? Have you guys figured out who does what here?
Well, right now it's all hands on deck. I would say that we're all doing a lot of work to get this up and running, but Caroline is the general manager of High Valley Transit, and she directs the work of VIA. She works closely with Tom as we're still utilizing some county services. Eventually, like the other service districts, actually will be a little different from the other service districts in that due to state statute, we really become an independent service district. But right now, we still have a very close relationship with Summit County as we're getting up and running.
Right. And as an independent service district, that would mean that you could actually tax, correct?
That's correct. And we will assume the taxes that have already been approved that are directly related to transit.
Right, right.
And again, that'll be discussed in more detail at our next meeting. And I do want to note that if you go onto the county's website and go to the sidebar on the left and go to the agendas and minutes tab, you can find High Valley Transit on there. High Valley Transit will have the March 11th meeting, and if they want to see previous agendas and minutes, they'll need to go down to the Snyderville Basin Public Transit District. But they're all on there, and you can sign up to get agendas if you're interested in attending those meetings, and we encourage people to get involved and give us input. Okay. I also wanted to note, I know you've had some questions in the past regarding having input from actual riders, and we feel that's very important. And we do have a steering committee that was put together for that very purpose. And so it's made up of regular users of the system, of businesses that utilize the system for their employees, and other interested parties.
Okay, Kim. Hey, thanks for your
time. And they meet monthly. All right. Thank you.
That's a member of the High Valley Transit Board of Directors. Kim Carson, you're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Park City Council member Steve Joyce. Well, a popular 80s comedy has finally produced a sequel 32 years later. In this week's Friday Film Review, Mark Harrington sizes up the new film and says it was not worth the wait.
This week's film is Coming to America, Eddie Murphy's sequel to his 1988 romantic comedy about an African prince who flees his father's palace to avoid an arranged marriage. Prince Akeem, played by Murphy, landed in New York City and found his true love in Queens. The original film staggered out of the gate with production mayhem and a lawsuit by Art Buchwald, who successfully sued the producers for stealing his story. But the film's blend of slapstick, lampoon, and cheesy romance, all powered by an Eddie Murphy at the height of his comedic career, struck a chord with audiences. Coming to America went on to gross over $200 million and has since attracted a cult-like following. Despite the passing of over three decades, most of the original characters are back, including the 88-year-old James Earl Jones, Arsenio Hall, John Amos, and Shari Headley. The plot picks up on Prince Akeem's 30th wedding anniversary to Lisa, his true love from Queens. Prince Akeem is about to become king, but his father fears that his weak son will be assassinated upon coronation, and Akeem has only three daughters. Their fictional kingdom, Zamunda, only recognizes sons as potential heirs to the throne. But hold on. The king informs Akeem that he in fact left an illegitimate son in Queens. So, Akeem fuels up the royal jet and returns to Queens to find his son and return him to Zamunda, where he will guarantee succession and block a neighboring general, played by Wesley Snipes, who has his eyes on Akeem's oldest daughter. Unfortunately, most of the action takes place in fictional Zamunda, depriving the script of the New York culture clash that anchored much of the original film's humor and appeal. Flashy costumes and musical acts dominate the first half of the film, depriving the audience from getting to know Akeem's daughters or any of the supporting cast beyond their blatant caricatures. Jermaine Fowler stumbles through a by-the-numbers slapstick routine as Akeem's missing son, Lavelle. In the end, the theatrics of a dumbed-down satire interrupt any opportunity for audience connection with the main characters. Simply, there's no one in the story you feel like really rooting for or laughing with, except Leslie Jones as Lavelle's ghetto mother. So, on my ski trail rating system, Coming to America earns my lowest green ski trail rating. Unless, of course, a combination of lowbrow, Sacha Cohen-like Borat parody crossed with solid gold dance shows is your idea of a good time at the movies, in which case you'll bump up to an intermediate blue. Beautiful costumes, great musical cameos, and strong performances during the second half of the film by Murphy and Kiki Lane as his oldest daughter can't propel this retread into anything beyond a slow trip down memory lane. Coming to America is rated PG-13 for crude humor, sexual references, language, and politically incorrect parody, including but not limited to men, women, children, Africa, barbers, bathers, and militant dictators. Coming to America is currently streaming on Amazon Prime. This is Mark Harrington for KPCW's Friday Film Review.
Good morning. Well, last night's Park City Council meeting started and ended with two lengthy discussions on this summer's event schedule and an update from the city's housing department. On the phone with a recap, I have City Council Member Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. So the special events discussion centered around what exactly summer events might look like. Still a bit uncertain right now with vaccinations ongoing, but we really don't know what the pandemic's going to look like 3 months from now. So how much of the events calendar are we trying to set in stone, and how much is just a wait and see?
I think what we're trying to do, I mean, it's very awkward. You just saw this from Savor the Summit where, you know, they're in a position where to have an event in June, you really need to start planning and nailing down all the details of, you know, who, what, where, you know, people renting, you know, tables and chairs and all that kind of stuff and planning menus and signing people up. And yet we really, as you just said, don't know what it's going to be like or how many people are going to be there and what social distancing requirements they're going to be and that kind of thing. And so it's really awkward for, you know, the applicants who want to have these events. But it's, it's equally awkward for the city because, you know, we had Phil Bondurant from the health department on, and, you know, we're asking questions about, well, what exactly does this, you know, House Bill 294 mean to us from masking? And not sure. So I don't know. It's going to be an awkward time. Everybody's going to have to be really flexible.
Councilmember Becca Gerber brought up not layering so many events on the weekends in order to spread things out. So if the city decides to scale back the events calendar, how tough of a decision will it be if some events need to be cut?
Boy, I'm not sure yet. I mean, for some of these things, we may see events cancel themselves for this same kind of reason we saw with Savor the Summit. But we do have some overlaps with, you know, Silly Market and the 4th of July. It's not clear what we should be doing for the 4th, quite honestly. I mean, you know, historically, we bring 40, 50,000 people and stand shoulder to shoulder for, you know, a mile of a parade. That's probably not the right thing to be doing in any world I can imagine starting in July. But I don't know how you scale that back. So I think we're going to have to look to the event planners working with our event people and our staff, like the, you know, the police and the health department and that kind of thing, to come to us with some recommendations.
Yeah. So speaking of the 4th of July, I mean, isn't it just easy to say, you know what, we'll get back to it next year?
You know, I actually threw that out, but I don't think that's a very popular opinion. There's a lot of people who really, you know, are feeling the urge to get back to something like normal. And I think if there was a way, you know, if you could kind of do a thing that says, well, this year, the 4th of July is only going to be for locals. And so instead of having 40 or 50,000 people, we're going to have 5,000. Well, okay, that would be nice, but I don't know how to make that happen. I mean, quite frankly, I think it's impossible. So, you know, I think I personally am going to be more on the conservative side of, you know, ease into this slowly. And if it's a really tough, sketchy decision, then the answer should be either no or scale it back dramatically. But, you know, I am but one of five council members, and we haven't really seen any kind of rock-solid proposal yet, so.
Yeah, and it seems to be, there seems to be some uncertainty when it comes to the regulations about limiting those crowd size and requiring masks. I mean, certainly private companies, you know, like Deer Valley could do it at their concert series. Could the city do that as well?
You know, the thing that Phil brought up that was interesting is for places and events where you can ticket, you know, as a control mechanism, that seems to be working because you can decide, do I want to have 1,000 people or 5,000 people or 10,000 people or whatever, even if the ticket itself is free. But, you know, what I couldn't figure out is when we start looking at things like, you know, the 4th of July, you know, how do you ticket the 4th of July parade? You know, it spreads throughout the community and down Main Street and, you know, down to City Park. And I can't even fathom how you would control it that way. But yeah, things like the Deer Valley concerts or any of the things like the Park City Institute, I mean, they've got, you know, pretty rigid controls just by based on the number of tickets they sell.
Oh, you could put it in the water bill too, the ticket, but let's see, even though sales tax numbers have exceeded the projections, lodging has fared quite a bit worse with the TRT revenue down about 18%, I guess, for the year. Still less than a 20% decline though from the best year ever. Is that a bad thing?
I personally am stunned. I mean, I really believed that we would see something much more like our sales tax projections where, you know, we would be off by, you know, 50% year to year or something like that. And then we just got lucky, quite frankly. It's not necessarily lucky for our caseloads, but, you know, a lot of people wanted to get out of the big cities and get out to where they could, you know, recreate outdoors. And we ended up with a lot of people showing up here, not just as tourists, but also as, you know, second homeowners and new full-time people. You know, I've met quite a number of them who've, you know, maybe they were part-time before and they've said, nope, we're here for stay now. You know, we're good.
Let's move on to housing. Council saw an income breakdown of the Park City workforce. According to the data there, most of the current workforce would actually not have much access to the city's affordable housing offerings as they're currently priced. So was this a bit of a wake-up call here?
I think so. I was really happy that we got these numbers, and thanks to Jeff Jones at the county for providing them for us. Yeah, I think at some level, in most places, if you said, hey, we're, you know, doing, you know, either rentals or sales at 80% of the median income, that would probably get a huge part of the kind of workforce that we're talking about. But here, where there's such a discrepancy between the cost of building housing and the salaries, it's kind of the haves and haves not have nots. The, you know, the median income is upwards of $100,000, and not many jobs here in town pay anywhere close to that. So I think it was a real wake up call that there's a lot of key positions that are at, you know, 40 or 50 or 60% AMI, and most of what we've done in the past has been more in kind of the 70 to 80% range, and some, you know, where we've done attainable is even up to like 120%.
Yeah. Well, we heard the summary from the Public-Private Partnerships Task Force. So in short, I mean, why do city projects cost more than private developments? Is it just the net zero and contaminated soil?
You know, it's going to be interesting to see. I think Tim Henney brought up the point that it's hard to do apples to apples. It's easy to look at a project and go, oh, I could build it cheaper than that. But, you know, the question is, well, could you build it cheaper than that if you were building it here on this lot where it's difficult, or respecting our historic district, and you're not only doing new buildings, but you're updating the historic buildings that are on that site. And, you know, there's a whole set of other things, some of which are just generic to Park City, like labor costs are higher up here. But it doesn't matter whether you're private or public, your labor costs are going to be higher. But other things are kind of probably more about what we've chosen to do, where, you know, we really do want to do the affordable housing in town versus, you know, putting it out in Summit or Wasatch County somewhere. And boy, you know, land's expensive, land's difficult, there's soils ordinances, there's historic districts. I mean, there's a lot to work around.
Yeah, so council also looked at a request for qualification. What do you think that private developers are going to be able to come to the table with here?
I don't know. That's going to be interesting to see. You know, the one that's most interesting to me is some of these developers who've had a lot of experience with the tax credits. And that's something we've never been able to do as a city. But that's a way you can really end up providing some subsidies into an affordable housing development. And so I'd like to see that. I'd like to see, you know, if you've got somebody who's building a whole lot of property in this general area, I'll say, you know, the Wasatch back, then, you know, maybe there's some scale that they can bring to the table that that we, you know, can't do with our projects one at a time. But it's going to be interesting. I think that's kind of the adventure is this has been a long time coming, and I really hope we find some nice win-wins where a public-private partnership works better than either one of us doing it by ourselves.
Yeah, would the city require, though, a private developer to do the net zero that the city would do if it was its doing it itself?
You know, that's going to be an interesting discussion. There were a few little comments that were made in the chat on the Zoom last night about, you know, there's requirements for a lot of the things like these tax credits where you basically do green development or LEED development and that kind of stuff. But there's a kind of a diminishing return there that when you actually get to true net zero, it becomes a lot more expensive. And so I think that's going to be one of the discussions we'll have. And one of the nice values that we get from the developers is they can say, look, I can get you, you know, 80% of what you're looking for here at 50% of the cost, but that last 20% to get to net zero is going to cost the other 50%. And so I mean, if there's something like that, I mean, that's the kind of experience that we're really hoping we can get to find a better, you know, kind of return on our investment and get some more affordable units for the same amount of money.
Finally, we heard last night that the special public hearing on the Arts and Culture District will be held March 31st. And what do you expect to hear then?
You know, I think it's going to be just a whole lot of listening from our standpoint. Most of the feedback that we've gotten from people when we've had art and culture meetings have been very supportive of doing the art and culture district. I've heard more kind of personal, you know, one-on-one kinds of things where people are concerned about the expense and how we're going to pay for it and what the opportunity costs are. But we haven't heard that much from people on that kind of note. So I think it'll be interesting to see that the meeting on the 31st, we're actually going to be doing the Planning Commission interviews first, and then we'll switch over and do the, I think, nothing but public input on art and culture. I haven't seen the actual agenda, but I believe that's what it's going to be.
Okay. Finally, have you decided whether you're going to run for re-election? That window, I think, comes up here pretty soon.
Yeah, I can be completely definitive. I will not be running for re-election. So there's an open opportunity for somebody out there.
Okay. Well, why did you decide not to?
You know, for us, it's really a matter of, I've really enjoyed it, but my wife Julie and I have been here for 16 years, and we've kind of talked about, you know, is it time to go find someplace next, or do we want to go spend a year over in Europe while we're young enough to do it? And, you know, for me, if I was running and I got elected, then that's a pretty hard 4-year commitment. I don't want to like walk out halfway through it or something. So I just got to the point where, for, you know, personal and family reasons, it wasn't a smart thing for me to do to commit for another 4 years.
Okay.
If I was staying here, I would do it in a heartbeat.
All right, Steve, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Park City Council member Steve Joyce. On the phone now with an update from Wasatch County, I have County Manager Mike Davis. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
So before we get into the work meeting discussion, can you give us an idea of where the county is financially? We've heard from some municipalities, we've heard from Summit County, that the impacts of COVID really have not affected the tax revenues terribly. Where's Wasatch County?
We're in the same picture. When we started a year ago, when we looked at the potential of COVID and the other pitfalls that could come with it, we were projecting perhaps up to 20% in the decrease of some tax revenues in the sales tax area and so forth. But what has happened is actually our sales tax revenues have held, or actually are a little higher. The one area we have taken a hit on is the transient room tax, and that would be applicable, of course, to the number of stays, hotel room stays, and so forth. And so we're down, in the 12% range on the transient room tax. Everything else is doing well.
Yeah, 12%, that's not bad at all.
No, I was shocked. It was down as much as 20% at one time, but it has come back.
Okay, and what's the thought about summer events? I mean, is there a conversation taking place?
Yes, there is. And with anticipation of some of the changes that are coming through the state mandates on masks and the vaccination programs and so forth, we're trying to plan some of the events in hopes that we're still able to do them. We do recognize that if there were a resurgence, or if some statutes changed according to the state, the way the state handles the vaccinations and the COVID, the whole COVID thing, we may have to make some changes. But right now we're trying to make some plans to do a fair. We're trying to make some plans to do the rodeo and the derby and so forth. And certainly those final decisions will be made in the next month or two, but we're planning.
All right. Let's talk about affordable housing. It's been discussed for years. Sounds like the council may be ready to proceed with a few steps. You outlined in last week's meeting some of the things that could be done immediately to address the affordable housing situation. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, I think we're looking mostly at trying to raise the fee in lieu component of the affordable housing. We still have a lot of development in the county that are small-scale subdivisions. When I say small-scale, they're probably in the neighborhood of 30 homes or less, and some are in the dozen homes or so. And it's not conducive to building affordable housing in those types of developments, so we charge a fee in lieu. And that fee in lieu rate is just too low, and has been too low for many years. And we've tried to work through it. And the solution we have right now is to try and work closer with Heber City and Midway City. And so the idea is to they're looking at a consultant that's going to look at our ordinances between the three entities and try and get them closer together, so that we would be charging the same amounts, have the same type of criteria, so that we're all on the same page. And then they are looking potentially at hiring someone to run the program, and from a full-time standpoint. And we've had that in the past. Years ago, the county had full-time affordable housing directors. And when the last one left, we just, the board, the Affordable Housing Board, kind of took that over as their own because there wasn't really a lot going on at the time. And so they would collect the fees or take care of the issues that came about. But now we have a lot more going on. We have a lot in the Jordanelle that is actually building affordable housing. So we've got some management issues we've got to start to address for managing the affordable housing, and as well as look at these fee and lieus.
I heard the salary that you were talking about, maybe $20,000 to $25,000. That's going to be a person who needs affordable housing.
Yes, I don't know that that's quite correct on how they're looking at it. I think the consultant they're looking for to come up with what they're going to do as far as hiring the person will be in that range, but the consultant itself would be a market value type of a situation.
Okay. And then that fee in lieu, I mean, what are we talking about?
Well, currently it's at $28,000, which is just too low. They a previous study that was done a few years ago said it could go as high as $80,000, so it's probably somewhere in the middle there for us. In addition to this, we're also looking into the potential of doing some essential employee housing, trying to look at our school teachers and emergency service providers and so forth, deputies, police officers. And there may be an additional program with that that we're going to look at as well.
Okay. Wrap tax. It sounds like the county is holding a regional meeting to discuss the potential of putting a wrap tax question on the ballot for county residents to decide on. I guess I would ask, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's just, you just leave it up to the voters to decide.
There's a lot to what you say there. That is a good point. And I think part of what we want to try and organize is we've had requests from Midway and Heber to do that. The way the wrap tax works is if the county implements the wrap tax, none of the municipalities can implement a wrap tax. If the county doesn't do a countywide wrap tax, then the cities themselves can do individual wrap tax for their jurisdiction. And so we want to meet with Midway and Heber City to find out where their priorities are for the tax. There is only so much money that this can generate, and we want to make sure that if we do implement it countywide, that all the entities can get what they need. And so that will be one of the considerations. It could be that then they haven't really looked at it yet, but that maybe the county doesn't do a countywide wrap tax and allows the cities to just do their own individual, because the purposes for what they want to use the tax are so different. So those are the things that are going to be discussed at the meeting to determine where it goes. It's highly likely it will go to a ballot initiative to the public. It's just in what form. Is it the cities or is it a countywide?
Okay. Do you have a date for that regional meeting then?
It's the next regional meeting, and I do not have that with me, but it is scheduled. I just don't have that with me right now.
Okay. Wanted to talk to you about MIDA. District 53 Representative Mike Kohler joined the work session with an update. He said that the bill that allows MIDA to access state funds behind closed doors pass-throughs, we're talking about some kind of state bank here. But let's take a step back. I mean, we started off with what was going to be the military conference hotel, a 400-room hotel, perhaps, and now it's blossomed into a massive ski resort with 4 to 5 hotels, thousands of acres of ski terrain, 1,400 homes, condos, ski beaches, all on a 40-year tax increment financing deal with Gary Barnett, a big developer out of New York City. How did this even happen? How did it get so big? Was that something that Wasatch County had welcomed?
Well, it made changes over time, and when it was first envisioned that this would happen, the project area was always considered to be this large area that would be a project area, and there would be the availability of tax increment, but the control of that project area was very small, and was one hotel, as you mentioned, that could be up to 400 or so rooms, and as the developer progressed with this, he wanted MIDA to be more in control than he wanted the county to be in control. And it was a political battle between us, and it's not one we could win. And so the whole Extel component of that went under the MITA control, and that's how it happened. The tax increment component is still the same, but the land use controls did switch to MITA. We work closely with them. We have some stop gaps in there. We're on the Development Review Committee board and the MITA board itself. We have representation, so we're trying to make that balance work with them now, but it is not quite what we envisioned when we first started, that's for sure.
Yeah, and then that increment financing, so it's kind of been broken down. I only got about a minute here, but it was, so from the time that the increment was frozen, everything going forward, 75% will go to MITA, 25% will go to Wasatch County taxing entities. So that has been split up between the school district, the fire district, Wasatch County, all of the taxing entities?
All the entities except Wasatch County. Wasatch County does not receive any of that, but the school district and the other entities do receive 25% of their portion. So that it's a lot of money, but it does come back somewhat to the county because we do receive, by agreement, all the municipal taxes that MITA would collect. So they can collect municipal taxes, and they give those back to us. And so that increment has to go towards financing of public amenities. And so the developer gets a portion of that, and then the rest of it goes into other projects such as the Jordan L. Parkway, infrastructure systems, and so forth.
Okay, so the school district gets 25% of what they would have gotten. The fire district gets 25%. It's not that 25% is not getting divvied up between those agencies.
No. They each get their 25% of what they would have received previously. And I think part of the discussion was the 25% they're going to receive is much, much higher than what they're receiving now. So it's a gamble of, by developing this, are we going to come out better for the next 20 years because we're receiving some of it, or do we wait until somebody can develop it and get all of it?
Okay. I got to leave it there. Always good to talk to you, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Have a great weekend. Remember, turn those clocks forward.